It's Tuesday, July 28, just after market close in New York. This is the Real Vision Daily Briefing. I'm Ash Bennington in New York, joined shortly by Max Wiethe. But first, Nick Correa with the day's stories.
Thanks, Ash. The Republicans' opening bid for a new stimulus bill came through Monday evening. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell announced the Health, Economic Assistance, Liability Protection and Schools, or HEALS Act, amounting to about $1 trillion. The bill the Democrats have in the Senate as their opening bid was passed through the House of Representatives back in May, and it amounts to roughly $3 trillion. However, the negotiations ahead will be strenuous. Considering the gap in the amount of funding proposed by the two parties, the vehement policy differences between the two bills, Republican intra-party conflicts, and the time crunch introduced from programs such as enhanced unemployment benefits having effectively ended, passing a new bill within the next few days prior to congressional recess may seem nigh to impossible. Democrats have heavily criticized the GOP for how long it took to propose their bill, as well as how their bill provides too little aid.
We've waited months, months, for the Republican COVID relief bill. And it turns out we won't even get a bill, and Republicans probably won't support it. Worse still, based on reports and Leader McConnell's speech just now, the Republican legislative response to COVID-19 is totally inadequate. The Republican proposal will ignore not one or two or three, but scores of major crises in America right now.
To quickly review the Democratic bid, House Democrats had passed the Health and Economic Recovery Omnibus Emergency Solutions, or HEROES Act, mid-May. It includes stimulus check payments sent to Americans that are within similar parameters set within the CARES Act. It also extends the enhanced unemployment benefits of an additional $600 per week through January 2021. The HEROES Act also extends the suspension of student loan payments through September 2021, no interest accrual, and up to $10,000 of student loan forgiveness for some federal and private loan holders. It also provides funding for rental and mortgage assistance, hazard pay for essential workers, and direct aid for states and localities. Part of the reason the HEALS Act has been introduced so late is that the Republicans have been experiencing intra-party conflicts concerning the stimulus package. In recent days, it's becoming more apparent how divided Republicans are over the amount of stimulus the U.S. economy and its citizens need. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina said over the weekend that half of the GOP would not be supporting the Republican bill, making the difficult negotiations ahead that much more intense. With less than 100 days to go for the 2020 elections, many Republican senators are under the gun to come up with a strong and decisive response to the pandemic. In their efforts to do so, they've somewhat distanced themselves from President Trump. For example, he has expressly stated that he wanted to see a payroll tax cut, which Republicans have dropped. They've also rejected President Trump's call to omit funding for coronavirus testing and to defund schools should they fail to resume in-person classes. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin have led the charge to supply an additional $1 trillion to the chagrin of a small but vocal faction of fiscal hawks, most notably Ted Cruz. And yet even Tom Cotton has voiced concerns that failing to deliver the necessary aid will damage the party's electoral chances in November. Because of this intra-party division, Senator Mitch McConnell will have to rely more on the Democratic vote to see a bill through, which will weaken the Republicans' position in these negotiations and could have a real impact on the election outcomes later this year. With that, I'll send it back over to Ash.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Thanks, Nick. Max, let's jump right in. What are we looking at today in markets?
Well, it started off pretty sleepy today. Markets were down, you know, a little bit to start. Didn't really do anything till around 3 o'clock. And sometimes that happens where all the real action happens either at the beginning of the day or the end of the day. And S&P closed down, NASDAQ down, European markets down. Bonds were up. Gold kept its head above water today as well. I think you especially and a lot of religion subscribers have been following crypto markets. Bitcoin had a big run yesterday, but I know a lot of focus has been placed on Bitcoin, but Ethereum, actually, if you go to like the 1 month chart of both of them, Bitcoin's up like 20% on the month. Ethereum, though, up 40%. I would love to get your take on why you think that is. I know that it's not really your thing when it comes to the crypto markets trying to talk about price movements, but I have to ask, why do you think that?
Lots to say there. Let's hit that later because we've got a lot to talk about up front. What were your thoughts, by the way, on Nick's intro?
On Nick's intro? Well, I think he pretty much touched on one of the most important things that's coming out in the coming, you know, weeks, months. We'll see how long it takes for this to all wrap itself up. I think that the stimulus plan that came out from the Republicans, although there is like a huge dearth between what the Democrats got through, I think the political pressure to get something through, especially with this being such a big election year, is so huge. I would be hard pressed to believe that they don't get something through before the election. And they've even said they want to get checks out in August. So, there's a lot of infighting going on within the Republicans as far as, you know, the political side of things. But I'm not as up to date on exactly what the provisions are of the different stimulus that's coming out, because we also got stuff from the Fed with them extending some of their liquidity provisions out until the end of the year. I know that you, as well as Nick, spent a lot of time today digging through that stuff. Can you go a little bit deeper into exactly what we're expecting from some of the stimulus?
Well, yeah, you know, that's exactly right, Max. And what I was thinking about today, we actually had a conversation around 9 o'clock this morning where we were talking about precisely this issue. And it got me thinking that it's probably worthwhile as we get into this, because sometimes it's easy to get lost in the weeds, especially with the congressional debating process as they go back and forth on these bills, to get lost about what the big picture is. And so here's the basic overview. Like, first, let's just set the stage, right? So US GDP had already slowed before the outset of COVID. From Q2 to Q4 of 2019, US GDP was already down to 2% QOQ SAAR. So on a quarter over quarter basis, seasonally adjusted annualized rate, 2%, right? The U.S. officially entered into recession in February of 2020. So really pre-COVID here in the U.S. And what's happened now is obviously there's been a massive stimulus response. The stimulus response obviously falls into two categories: the monetary response from the Fed, the central bank, and fiscal stimulus from Congress. Now, just a quick overview on the Fed. The Fed basically has three broad categories of policy actions that they can take. They can cut rates, they can buy assets, and they can change regulation. That's basically it. Those are basically the three broad policy buckets that the Fed has at their fingertips to execute policy. In this case, I guess not surprisingly, they did all three. Okay. So on the rate side, they cut rates a lot. They cut the Fed funds target rate from 1.5 to 1.75% range to 0 to 25 basis points. Now that is a big increment cut. They'd been raising at a quarter of a point at a time, and they cut obviously significantly more than that. They cut 1.5%. 150 basis points. They cut the discount rate from 1.5% to 0.25%, 25 basis points. Again, 125 basis point cut, another big cut. They made some regulatory changes. They changed some of the technical plumbing for reserve requirements, and they removed some restrictions on Wells Fargo that they had faced after the scandal involving creating sort of dummy accounts, as we all know. But the real action here, Max, takes place, the fireworks takes place on the asset purchase side. Here, the Fed goes absolutely gangbusters. They come in guns blazing, quantitative easing, credit easing. They're buying treasuries. They're buying MBS. It's open-ended, right? They intervene in the repo market, bid, 1.5 trillion in repo ops, then 2.0 trillion. This is injecting gobs of liquidity into the US banking system. They spin up a series of SPVs. Those are the special purpose vehicles. There's a whole alphabet soup that we've already discussed on past episodes of Real Vision Daily Briefing. There's the PDCF, the Primary Dealer Credit Facility, the MMLF, a liquidity facility for money market funds. There's the AMLF, the Asset-Backed Commercial Paper Market Funding Facility. It just goes on and on. They intervene in corporate credit markets. They intervene in the primary market. They intervene in the secondary market. And then, of course, there's the Paycheck Protection Program Lending Facility, the PPP. This is the Paycheck Protection Program that we've talked about. There's about $600 billion now in Main Street lending programs, and it's up to $10 million per company. And under some circumstances, it can be 100% forgivable. So that is the big picture here with the Fed side of the equation. Now let's move on and talk a little bit about the fiscal side, because this is where the congressional debate begins. So on the fiscal side, Congress passed three packages and one supplemental totaling $2.8 trillion in spending. The first two are relatively modest by congressional terms, about $12 billion between them. And then the CARES Act, which is phase three, is $2.3 trillion, and this did a series of stimulus actions in the U.S. economy: $1,200 to every adult, and $500 per child, mortgage forbearance, and the expansion of unemployment benefits, extending to the gig economy to furloughed workers who wouldn't otherwise be eligible, and ultimately the $600 a week in additional supplementary unemployment insurance that is currently being debated. You know, to get back to what Nick was talking about today, you know, we find ourselves in relatively unusual territory here. We have the heels versus the heroes. Those are the names of the two packages that the Democrats and Republicans are debating right now. Heroes being the Democrat side and the heels being the Republican side. I think we know who won the battle for naming there. But what's interesting about this, Max, is something that you actually alluded to, is there's intense rivalry right now within the GOP. This is extremely unusual. The GOP congressional caucuses are generally much better organized. They generally are much more focused, and they can generally get things done more easily than the fractious Democratic Party, which has historically, at least the last 30 years, been riven into multiple factions. But there are two clear factions that seem to be developing here on the GOP side: the pragmatists who want to spend more, and the hawks who are fiscal hawks who are averse to the spending. The opposition to the spending is led by Ted Cruz. Now, I'm curious to hear about what your thoughts are on this. To me, you know, there's a pragmatic element here that if you want to get reelected, you can't have the economy fall off a cliff face. Now, this isn't an economic argument, and I'm not making a normative view of what one party should or shouldn't do from a perspective of what's best for the economy. But it seems pretty clear that it's going to be really difficult to decrease the amount of stimulus that people are receiving and win re-election. The Dems already control the House. The Senate now is 53-47 in the Republican favor, and they could lose that. And there are numerous stories. I don't follow the political side as closely as I do the economic and financial side, obviously. But you keep reading these stories that the Republican leadership is bracing for losing the White House in November, and you have to wonder about whether or not they really want to be the party to blame for cutting those unemployment benefits supplements back from $600 to $200 per week as the plan now calls for. What are your thoughts on that?
I don't think it's as much to do with 600 versus 200. It's nothing versus something. And that's what I really think is going to happen. I think there will be something, whether it's 200, whether it's 600. I don't know, because the same thing goes for the Democrats. They see this as an opportunity for the proverbial blue wave. And if they can't get something across the finish line, they have the same sort of issues with trying to be able to take the Senate. I think it is really all about Mitch McConnell's majority that he has in the Senate. And some commentary has come out to say that, you know, that's really what it's all about. And the second that majority seems like it might be in danger because of this stimulus plan, that's when you're really going to see action. So I think that I just can't imagine them not getting something through on both ends, with the Democrats saying it's not enough. So we're not going to sign it because, you know, they got this through in May. They got their plan through in May. They have at the very front end been pushing how important it is to get this through now. It's not something that is supposed to be, it's not like Social Security that's going to be in place for 100 years. And so you have to get it right the first time because it's going through. Like, this is something, the whole reason that we have it is because we need it now, supposedly. And so the idea that you can sit on your ideological horse and not get something through, I just don't buy it on both ends. And actually, there was something that came out that said about 50% of the GOP is not going to vote for a phase four no matter what. Now, it's all about the Senate, which the interesting thing about the Senate is that there's 6-year terms. So there's a breakdown between people who are up for election now and there are people who are up for election in a few years. And I would be really interested to see how the voting falls along those lines.
Yeah, that's extremely well said, Max. I'm curious, you know, I tend to agree with you, the notion that that something is going to get done here. But if something does get done, and let's say there's the difference gets split between the 600 and the 200, let's say they land on 300 in a negotiated compromise, aren't Democrats going to relentlessly run ads saying that Republicans cut back by 50%, they cut in half the benefit, supplemental benefit that you were receiving, and they're the bad guys here? I mean, how do the optics of that play out in an election year where people feel real pain?
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510, is he declaring an emergency? There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Well, I think especially considering some of the other things that have gone in to the bill, that's a huge risk for them. The L in heels is liability protection for businesses that are opening in the face of the crisis. So to get the economy back to running, they want to protect those businesses who are rightfully worried about lawsuits from their employees, from their customers for opening too soon and exposing them to the virus. And the Democrats, I'm sure, would say, well, we wouldn't have to do that if we could just keep people safe, give them the money they need to get things to put food on the table. Then you wouldn't have to worry about getting the economy running when it's potentially too risky. So, yeah. I mean, that's a big ideological line that I think is the clear line in the sand. And just looking at the L in heels as the main difference between what the Democrats think is important and what the Republicans think is important.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting in terms of the L in heels. Like, there's an issue, and I'm just playing devil's advocate here. I'm thinking through this from a political perspective and not necessarily from a financial or economic perspective. But the question comes, you know, if you're right on substance, but you're wrong on optics, and you just get hammered in your state with the opposition party running ads that say Senator Wethy is the bad guy who decided to cut you back. You're $1,200 a month short because of what Senator Wethy voted for. He keeps talking about the L in heels, but that's the difference between, you know, your rent or your mortgage payment. I'm just saying this is something that could really be a difficult path for them to walk, for the Republicans to walk from a political perspective.
Well, I would just say on the flip side, if we're playing political, chess here, the idea that the Republicans could run the ads that would say you didn't get anything and it's because the Democrats weren't willing to meet us in the middle. Right. And the Republicans, like, I don't think there are many red senators from blue states that are, you know, I just think that the senators that are in the red states are the ones that are going to be safe in this sort of thing if they get something through. I think it's really just about getting something through.
Yeah.
But I think really thinking, bring it back to the market and less about what's going to happen, because I don't think either of us have this political crystal ball. It comes down to consumer confidence. And what we saw with the first stimulus is that incomes were replaced and more than replaced in a lot of circumstances. And so this could be another thing that gives puts a bid back up under the market. We saw consumer confidence miss after declining from the previous month. And I think that's directly related to worries surrounding this sort of thing. That $600, it's gone already. It's off. So it's not, they've already passed the line where they can debate and haggle and everybody is still fine. That's passed. So we're in go mode. So I think that this is going to move incredibly fast, but if it doesn't, I mean, that's your answer. Like if this doesn't happen quickly, you've got your answer on this.
Yeah. You know, and again, just to reiterate, we've been talking about this in the domain of politics and the term domain of perception and not in the domain of substance. And if this does, in fact, fail, it's a major sort of, I would think, a pox on both of your houses. I imagine that they're going to be pointing fingers at each other and it's just going to amp up the rhetoric and increase the pain, none of which are good for consumer confidence or for the broader economy.
Yeah. And we're already seeing, I wouldn't call it a faltering market, but the V-shaped bounce that we saw, which was really just, you know, a bounce from, like, we had fallen so far, there had to be some sort of bounce. But we're getting to the point now where it's about the substance of the recovery. And is this a total recovery? Is it a partial recovery? How much momentum are we going to have when we come out the other side of this? So I think we're starting to get into that period where markets are going to be especially reactive to this sort of thing. We saw today, as we talked about earlier, you know, kind of choppy during the morning and afternoon and a moderate sell-off at close, but, you know, not the same sort of steam that we saw in the past few months, except for those assets like gold and Bitcoin and Ethereum that are, you know, traditionally safety assets. We haven't had the rapid selling that we had back in March that caused it to be a total risk off sell off. But those sorts of things are holding their head up. And so I think to me that points to uncertainty in the market. We're seeing it across just about every single asset.
Yeah, more on digital assets in a second, but just to call back to the consumer confidence numbers that you mentioned that came out at 10 a.m. this morning. I think this is an important point. The actual number today, 92.6, off a consensus of 95.7. So obviously below consensus. But as you pointed out, Max, I think the bigger drop here is from prior revise of 98.3. That's a pretty significant contraction. That's a real material decline in the perception of consumer confidence.
Yeah, it really is. And you know, I know personally, I'm kind of like right in that sweet spot. Like I'm very fortunate to have a job right now, but I have expenses and I'm in that period of time and in that income range where every dollar sort of counts. And I know personally what $1,200 would do for me, the $1,200, which ironically is the thing that there is no debate about. So in both bills, the $1,200 check is right in there. The unemployment insurance is the big debate. And we've spent the whole time talking about unemployment insurance and not really about loans to small businesses or the PPP, which is, I think, telling to me, because you could argue that on a, you know, total dollars basis, that is going to be just as big in terms of whatever gets passed. But it's the consumer. It is the everyday American that is grabbing the headlines and the focus of the politicians. And I think it's very clear why.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It's probably because those programs are far safer. You get 10 or 12 rather men and women who have PhDs in economics into a room. They close the door. They hash something out between them, and then they make an announcement. It's not the vaudeville show we've got going on the other side of Pennsylvania Avenue in Congress, right? I mean, look, if there's anything in America right now that progressive Democrats and conservative Republicans agree on, it's the dysfunction of Congress. It is the one unifying universal principle that's generally true in American politics and is now true even more so. So all of those programs that are coming out of the Fed, the trillions of dollars in stimulus, are relatively simple in terms of their ability to get approved, because you just have to get 12 people together to agree on it. There's not a political process, and it happens behind closed doors. Now, you could argue about what that means for long-term deficits and debt and what the impact is going to be in the economy. I'm generally much more sympathetic to central bankers, I think, than some people who are sort of skeptics on that side. I'm skeptical, I guess. I'm skeptical about the long-term impact. But I just feel that you have like 12 people who are sitting in a room going, if we don't get this done, God knows what Congress is going to do. We need to step up and pull the trigger and just do something, because we know for certain, and I think this is their driver, right? At a very simplistic level, we know for certain at the Fed, at the FOMC, that if we do nothing, things are going to get horrible and horrible in a hurry. Now, that is in no way to diminish the potential long-term consequences of effectively unlimited federal stimulus coming out of the Fed. But I think that's what they think when they look at these markets and when they look at this economy.
Yeah, and I'm like you. I try not to think about the ethical questions about what my job is to determine if and what the potential effects are going to be for markets. So you know, I'm not going to comment on whether I think it is a good idea or not. But yeah, I would have to agree. But you know, just to try and bring it back to markets, as I like to do, that's why we're seeing what we're seeing from precious metals. And I'm going to put it to you this time, cryptocurrencies, what is happening there?
Final time, third time's a charm, Max. I will answer that question. So also gold closed today, 1960, up about 0.75%. So the big news, if you are watching financial news channels, is the price of Bitcoin heading near to 11,000 today, obviously crossing 10,000 earlier this week. These are big headline marquee numbers, and they're getting a lot of press coverage. You know, for me, I think the real story here is Ethereum. Ethereum has tripled in price since April. It came in, it was about $100 in March. April, end of March, beginning of April, was about $100. We're trading at about 315 on Ethereum right now as we film. But there are very sort of broad-based measures that are increasing, that are measurable in the Ethereum market. So contract calls, which are a measure of network usage, you can think of these kind of as a test net, have doubled in the last 12 months, which appear to be a harbinger of increased volume to come. And then, of course, the big meta theme here is the rise of DeFi, which is quadrupled by TVL. That's the total value locked. That's the key measure that we use to talk about the full market value of DeFi, has quadrupled to year to date, which is a pretty extraordinary statistic. And of course, the main technological driver here is Ethereum 2.0, which is scheduled to be released later this year, which has some major technical changes underneath the hood, moving most prominently from a proof of work mechanism, which is the general method of gaining consensus that's used by Bitcoin, to a proof of stake mechanism. Obviously, the technical scope of what's happening there is beyond this conversation, but it is a significant change in the way that the protocol will operate.
Okay. Well, it sounds like a lot of the things that you're talking about, specifically with Ethereum 2.0, are much longer term than Bitcoin ripping this month. So I would just like to know how you, as somebody who really does take a longer term view, more focused on the underlying technology and the use cases, those sorts of things, how do you think about the market when you have a month like this, or really a week like this, where things are moving? And I'm sure you get questions from family members and things like that about, should I be buying Bitcoin and all sorts of things. So what do you think, as somebody who really doesn't look at Bitcoin as a trader, when you have a move like this?
You know, I see this. I tend not to pay too much attention, frankly, to the weekly and monthly gyrations in price. Obviously, I notice it. I'm a financial markets reporter. It's impossible to ignore. But that's really not what I'm focusing on. I'm thinking about, where are we going to be in 3 to 5 years? Where are we going to be in a decade? What are the technologies that are going to have a major impact on the way that we conduct finance and frankly, in the way that we lead our lives? And Ethereum, as well as Bitcoin, and by the way, Bitcoin is by no means obsoleted by the rise in Ethereum and the new changes that are coming in 2.0. It just seems to be that there's more incremental interest right now in terms of new people who are joining a particular development community or who are following it. So all of these, it's not going to be a single winner here, in my view. You know, the short answer is I just try not to pay attention to it. I try not to get hooked into that. Now, I know that's difficult to do if you've recently bought Ethereum or Bitcoin, because you're, you know, depending this month you're euphoric and maybe a few months ago you were clinically depressed. But for me, that's not what this space is about. You know, there's an interesting story. There's a great interview today in CoinDesk, an interview with a gentleman named Heath Tarbert, who some of our viewers who follow traditional finance may know is the current CFTC chairman. And Heath Tarbert is a really interesting guy. He's like a PhD lawyer from Oxford. He's obviously a very brilliant, very thoughtful guy, and he's younger than I am, which is intensely depressing. And he's incredibly interested in this space. And he gives a detailed interview to CoinDesk today. And just one quote that's a great takeaway for me is he says, quote, "When you think about the idea that at some point a large part of our financial system could very well exist in blockchain format, that's revolutionary." So you have the chairman of the CFTC talking in a way that, you know, 3 years ago, you would probably only attribute to crypto evangelists, you know, your nephew who had come home from college and not stop talking about Bitcoin. This is the CFTC chairman. Now, CFTC doesn't regulate, obviously, all areas that are managed in the cryptocurrency complex, but they manage and regulate a significant portion of it. And most prominently in October, Tarbert declared that Bitcoin was in fact security, but Ethereum was a commodity. And that's a significant statement because it gives the CFTC regulatory authority over Ethereum and some of the Ethereum derivatives products that are associated with it.
Interesting. Well, I would just say, you know, if you apart from a few months, maybe back when we hit 13,000 and then that big brush up in 2017, I can't think of any other times that you wouldn't be up. Like I just looked at the year to date chart of Bitcoin, you're up. If you had just held all the way through the madness that we saw Ethereum, if you held, you're up. You know, maybe not as much as you would be if you were trading around it, but taking that sort of set it and forget it view can be just as beneficial as trying to pick tops and bottoms in the crazy world of crypto.
In 2017, when Bitcoin crossed briefly, depending upon which exchange you looked at, the 20,000 mark, I was actually running markets coverage at CoinDesk, and I was completely immersed in that at the time. And you're right. And by the way, Max, that's the least cynical I've ever heard you on the concept of cryptocurrency.
Well, I was playing a role the last time we talked. You know, I was just trying to be the foil, and you know, myself, I have my own. I've owned it. I've owned different cryptocurrencies over the years. I have sold them. I've thought, my view is that if there is going to be a total redux in the financial system, that there is going to be some serious pain, and it's going to be risk off all the way around, and you will have an opportunity to buy. Because if we're getting out of the current financial system with the bank, like there's going to be a major risk off event, and based on what we've seen from cryptocurrencies, you'll have a chance. So I'm not one of those guys who's like, this is the last chance to buy above 10,000 or below 10,000. Like you see those tweets all the time. You know, I think that there were good times to buy, and you know, I don't think that. You interviewed who was it? Those two guys who the high frequency traders. Like, there's plenty of good ways to trade around crypto assets. It's not my world.
Yeah, and generally, when someone's telling you it's the last time to buy, they're trying to sell you something.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that I have a problem with the space. It's like if I've never heard of a good company that needs to be pumped like so much. Like Jeff Bezos is not out there pumping Amazon. Like he just goes about his business. He rolls things in, grows his revenues, keeps reinvesting, keeps taking advantage of the tax code, does all of that stuff. He doesn't need to go out. And partially that's because it isn't as revolutionary. Like I am sympathetic to the idea that there's a lot of education that needs to happen in the space. But yeah, as somebody who follows all different types of traditional assets, it does just kind of rub me a little, it just makes me a little cringy, but
I'm trying, I'm trying to think of the least cynical reply to that, Max, and I think you hit on it, actually. There's a lot of education that needs to take place in this space. Look, let's be blunt. There are a lot of scams as well, right? There are, when you have asset classes that are moving up into the right this quickly, you are going to attract some significant unsavory elements into the space, right? And I think, look, it is fair to say that there is a lot of education that needs to take place in the space, and some of it is just that. People want to get their story out there. They feel that they need to get their story out there. Some of it is that it's just not been a regulated space for many years, so you don't have the tradition of compliance lawyers tapping you on the shoulder saying, hey, you can't say that, so people aren't thinking about self-censoring. There are a lot of reasons for it. But look, it's the classic example of what a gold rush looks like, right? You have real revolutionary things that are taking place in this. It's a gold rush into new technology, I should say. You have revolutionary things taking place. If we went back to the dot-com era in the 1990s when I was about your age and working on Wall Street, look, there were some unsavory players there. There were pump and dump schemes. There was stuff that was happening in the pink sheets that was repulsive, right? There were all kinds of things that were happening. And yet, we were building out the infrastructure that was going to allow us to do this, you know, to do this conversation over Skype and deliver it end-to-end digital into your browser. So while there's real innovation that's happening in the space, there are definitely some things that we will look back on and cringe.
Well, actually, that gives me the perfect opportunity to plug a little content that I'm proud of. So next week, an interview with Quentin Matthews, who's a short seller, is going out. And we make a little bit of the comparison between crypto and activist short selling. The idea that there are some people who ruin it for everybody. But obviously, the whole reason that this exists is because there are obvious flaws in the system. Like, crypto wouldn't exist if the banking system was perfect and nobody had any problems with it. And activist short selling wouldn't exist if there wasn't rampant fraud in the corporate world all over the globe. So
very well said, Max. And I think that's the perfect last word. Thanks for joining us.